but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Every week, John Wilner joins us to talk college football. He is the guru, and you can find his work at wilnerhotline.com. He's been covering this sport for longer than a lot of you have been alive, and he's joining us now via satellite. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. I'm glad to be alive. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. What was your first beat you were on? Let's go back through this, the history of John Wilner's career. Like, let's look at the resume.
Oh, I don't know how many people are going to want to hear this. The resume, I started my career covering as the beat writer for the Arizona basketball team for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson.
Okay. Great
and
experience.
Then Lute I Olson? Worked, yeah. Lute Olson. Yes. It was a great experience. And then I worked in L.A. covering UCLA football and basketball for the L.A. Daily News.
Awesome.
And then I moved to the Mercury News, covered Stanford football and basketball.
Yeah.
And then transitioned into this period where I did, you know, a lot of Pac-12 stuff, a lot of national, regional stuff, kind of where things are right now.
All right. So let's go back because I went and covered Bobby Knight for a year, and then I had Tark for several years. And I still feel like I utilize things I learned on those beats today. What did you learn on that Arizona beat with Lute Olson that maybe you carried forward with you for years and years?
I mean, the biggest thing of all, and it was partly my interactions with Lute himself, but also just all the folks around the basketball program. It is all about journalism. It is 99% about relationships, right? Now, a lot goes into that relationship piece: trust, accountability, information sharing, all those things. But it's so much about relationships, and so is college sports. And we have seen that on the West Coast in all its inglorious form. And you know, a lot of the destruction of the Pac-12 was because of poor relationships between various stakeholders. But to me, that was the thing I learned the most. Is just, you got to learn how to deal with people.
So,
and
I mean, Arizona basketball at that time, like Lute Olson always played to me like such a gentleman. But what was he like as a beat guy?
Yes, he did outwardly, but he was very difficult with the local media. He, you know, like a lot of these guys, a control freak. And when you've got a very successful coach, a Hall of Fame level coach in a college town, there's a lot of the control freak aspects of it that the beat writers have to deal with, whether it's, you know, you write something they don't like and the repercussions or the closing of practices or limitations on player availability, all those kind of things, right? And we see that even today. It's more prevalent in college towns because the coach has more control, football or basketball, they got more control. But it and it's also very different now with the way media is. But that was a big thing, was dealing with his instinct to be a control freak. And that instinct helped him be an incredibly successful coach, but it wasn't always easy as the beat writer for the primary media outlet.
I learned, like, when I got to Indiana, the first thing I noticed seeing the IU contingent, the media contingent, was there were a bunch of people there that had been sort of beat down over the years by Knight and ground down. And
yeah,
and they were just kind of, he had them under control. And I had the luxury of knowing I was passing through Wilner and I wasn't going to be there forever. And so I think I was able to maybe write some things and do some things that others would not do. Because, you know, you were never going to be in his good graces if you criticized him. And But I learned that in that experience, and maybe with Tark too, because Tark, like Loot, could turn the crowd against you just by going on radio and saying, you know, oh, that guy, you know, he comes into practice, and he could turn the crowd, the mob against you, like, you know, on the dime. But I think I learned in those times, like, hey, I've got to sleep at night. And so and I slept well because I felt like I wrote what was true. Did it help you knowing that you weren't going to be in Tucson forever?
Well, you know, I don't know that I'm trying to think back. It was so long ago, but I don't know that I viewed I was there 6 years, and I'm not sure that at least the first three or four that I really thought about, you know, am I going to be a short timer here? Am I leaving? Am I going to be in Tucson for another 10 years for the rest of my life? I don't know that I thought about that consciously and had it affect the decisions I made on the beat. But certainly I get where you're coming from, and that, you know, it is different. It is different if you're young and then rather than if you're an established media member who is, you know, definitely a lifer.
The experience at UCLA, I am fascinated by maybe what you saw there and how it relates to what you see happening today. Was the culture at UCLA, do you have the Rosetta Stone more or less for what is playing out now?
Yeah, I feel like I do. And I've stayed in contact with some people who have been very close to UCLA football for many, many decades. And I am amazed and also not surprised that so much of the frustration UCLA fans have right now is directed at Martin Jarmond and Chip Kelly. And I am not absolving either of them of the responsibility for the state of the program right now. But come on, UCLA hasn't won a Pac-12 or conference championship in almost 30 years. I was the beat writer the last time it happened, 97-98 under Bob Toledo. I was at the Miami game, the Hurricane George game, when they blew it and Edgerrin James ran for 8,000 yards. It is all about 50% of the problem at UCLA has been the administration over the decades and the lack of commitment to football. Mostly Gene Block, the chancellor for 17 years, but also his predecessors. 25%, if I'm dealing out the blame, 25 to 30% on Jarmond, 20-25% on Chip, and half of it is about the administration. Because all these folks saying it's all Jarmond's fault and Chip's fault, well, then how do you explain the lack of conference championships and the paucity of 10-win seasons for all those decades before Jarmond and Chip showed up?
Yeah, they've had no proof of performance. They've had no success, virtually no success.
One or two years under Jim Mora, and that was it. It is much deeper. Much deeper than just two guys. Now, Jarmond misplayed the situation. He's had trouble getting the budget under control, and the hire of Deshaun Foster was bad. And Chip, you know, he did some quiet quitting on them, didn't like to recruit. But if you think it's all about Martin and Chip, then you weren't paying attention for 25 years before they showed up.
How does UCLA basketball sort of, you know, act as its own ecosystem? Ben Howland wins, Mick Cronin wins to an extent. We've seen other coaches win there, obviously the John Wooden back in the day. But how is basketball sort of fly above it?
Well, I think that they lean into their history, which in all ways is unsurpassed, you know, to do that. And it's a more coveted job for coaches than UCLA football. The resource commitment is much less than football, so you can get away with it. And also, I mean, they're a basketball school. It's hard to be good at both over a sustained period of time. You know, we see that with Kansas. We see that with Indiana, Syracuse, Kentucky football. Right? It's hard to be good at football consistently if you are a basketball school. North Carolina, another great example. Duke. And so, you know, UCLA, they haven't been great. I mean, Howland, Cronin's had a couple of good seasons. I think that the Big Ten thing is hard for them, too. but it's just easier. And you've got that lure in Southern California of UCLA basketball that still exists, like it still exists for USC football.
John Wilner is with us. He is the co-host of Canzano and Wilner, the podcast. You can check out those episodes on YouTube. He also
I am the wingman.
College football at large for the Mercury News in San Jose. Listen, you and I talked about this on the podcast. Oregon, among the four Pac-12 schools that went to the Big Ten, it's working for Oregon. And maybe they're just more well-positioned in this era, this Wild West era of NIL and portal. But not working as well for the others. And maybe that Washington-Ohio State game and maybe Washington's game this week with Maryland provides sort of some insight into that.
Well, certainly Washington, you know, if Ohio State and Oregon are the standard in the Big Ten, right? I mean, Washington is a long way from there, I think. Certainly another recruiting cycle, if not two, away. And I would argue USC's closer to Washington. In terms of their competitive standing within the Big Ten, I'd argue USC is closer to Washington than it is to Oregon and Ohio State. And UCLA is on a whole nother level, right? I mean, their competitive standing is closer to the Mountain West at this point. And Oregon has been, in a lot of ways, building to this era for 20 years and is perfectly set up for the NIL portal rev share era. Now, I give Dan Lanning credit. I think he's the perfect coach for Oregon right now, but I also think it's like two things are equally true. Lanning's a perfect coach for Oregon right now, but he also has a great foundation, a better foundation for success, certainly than exists at Washington. There's no comparison there, right? The Nike presence, all those decades, Phil Knight's contributions, the Division Street organization, everything about Oregon is set up to thrive in this era. And they have, you know, aside from a bad Rose Bowl, they have been as good as anybody in this era.
Wilner, Washington, you know, Oregon, Dan Lanning's complaining about, hey, I don't have the prep time. But you point out, you think Washington is getting the raw steel of them all.
Yeah, I do. I mean, Lanning, what he said there is only half valid because he left out some important details. Washington, to me, has got a much bigger gripe. The Huskies play four teams that are coming off byes when Washington is not coming off a bye. And that includes this week. Huskies obviously played Ohio State at home last weekend. Tough game physically, emotional game. And now they got to go across the country and play Maryland, and Maryland's have been off for 2 weeks. Maryland's at home, sitting around for 2 weeks. Washington is traveling. It is the worst, excuse me, it's the biggest competitive disadvantage basically you could have in college football in the current era based on, you know, college, how the conference scheduling works. The Big Ten did them dirty. The Big Ten knows they did them dirty. And the Big Ten would say, you know what? It's impossible to make completely fair schedules for 18 teams. There's going to be some years where it's uneven and a school or two draws a real short straw. It happened to Washington this year. We just have to make sure it doesn't happen to Washington next year and the year after. In other words, the short straws need to be balanced out over the period of five or six seasons. And I think that the Big Ten is right, but they've got to show it next year and make sure Washington doesn't get hosed.
Well, when is Michigan and Ohio State's short straw year?
Well, there's no short straws for them. And the thing is, they shouldn't have the short straws because Michigan and Ohio State together are worth much more than half of the Big Ten's media value. They are the kingpins of the conference. And if the Big Ten is treating them the same as the other 16, the Big Ten would be dumb. Just like the Pac-12 was dumb to treat USC the same as it treated Washington State and, you know, Arizona or whatever. You have got to lean into your biggest brands and keep them happy if you're going to survive. And I think the Big Ten, Washington and Michigan and Ohio State are not going to face the same logistical challenges, and they shouldn't.
Wilner, are you willing to pick Maryland in an upset of Washington this weekend?
Easy. No question.
You're picking them to win outright.
I think not only – well, I was – first of all, I was a little bit surprised by the spread.
Yes.
The last time I looked, Washington was favored by 6.5.
Yeah.
I would have figured, you know, given the logistics for the Huskies – and, in fact, Maryland is undefeated.
The quarterback's not bad.
Has a good quarterback.
Yeah, he's good.
So I was surprised that they were favored by 6.5. I don't know what the current line is, but I think Maryland's going to win the game outright.
Wilner, Oregon State's in a tailspin. They're 0-5. They're going to Appalachian State. I got grief for that this week on my pronunciation.
Yep.
Boone, North Carolina is the trip. Is it a must win? Trent Bray says they're all must wins, but I kind of think this is a must win.
If they lose, then they have no margin for error to get bowl eligible, right? They'd have to win out. So if you're looking at it through the postseason lens, it's pretty darn close. But I think just generally speaking, he needs a win as fast as he can get. He needed a win weeks ago, right? I don't know that he can survive. I know Oregon State wants to keep him around, but if they finish 2-10, I don't know if that's feasible. And, you know, the Cougars, they got two games against the Cougars who are looking better after they changed quarterbacks. Who else they got? Who's
Tulsa,
after Appalachian
Lafayette,
State? Tulsa.
Wake Forest
Tulsa
coming up
just
at
beat
home.
Oklahoma State. Wake Forest is a decent ACC school. I mean, they gotta win soon. And the thing is, Appalachian State has had some very good teams over the years. This isn't one of them. They just got beat badly at Boise. I think Oregon State, if they play like they did for three quarters against Houston, they should go win this game.
They win this game.
Now, I don't know if they will.
How about Washington State? I don't know what to make of them. Are they good? Are they decent? Are they bad? Depends on which game.
Yeah, it does. I think you kind of have to judge them now based on how they're doing with the new quarterback, Sebby Eckhouse, who should have been starting from the get-go. And I think if you're a Washington State fan, you should be wondering what the heck Jimmy Rogers and his staff were looking at, that they didn't start Eckhouse from day one, or at least after the first game when they struggled against Idaho. So to me, that's a little bit of an eyebrow raiser. But if you're going to judge them on how they played with him in charge, I think that they're pretty good. And I would give them a decent chance to win three more games and get bowl eligible, especially because they got two games against the Beavers, right? Their schedule on the whole is harder than Oregon State's. They got Virginia and Mississippi back-to-back, right, on the road. But they do have a few winnable games down the stretch, and their offense has been better. I think that they've got a real chance to get to 6-6.
John Wilner is with us. Finally, I want to summarize Oregon's wideout victory. What did you make of Oregon going into Penn State and winning the way they did?
Well, very impressive for sure. Especially the way I thought the way Oregon kind of handled things on the line of scrimmage was real impressive. The pressure they got on Drew Aller consistently, very impressive. The most impressive thing is that they let the thing slip away, and then they're behind in overtime, and they find a way to make a play or two on offense in the first overtime session, and then they make another play or two on offense, and then they make the big play on defense, right? They were in control, lost control, and then still managed to win the game in that environment. To me, that was the most impressive thing about it, and probably will serve them better the way the whole thing unfolded, maybe serve them better than if they had just gone in there and that lead had remained double digits all the way. I think that they probably learned something about themselves the way the trajectory played out.
How do they end up hosting a playoff game? Because that's what they want, isn't it? Don't they? They don't want a repeat of last year and sitting around a little bit and being being undefeated and the one seed.
Nope.
You know, all of that. We went through that.
It's tough. Yeah, I mean, I think Oregon needs to do whatever it can do to host a game. The problem is that the thing it's got to do is lose twice, probably lose twice. The sweet spot is the 5, 6, 7, 8 seed because you get a home game. In the opening round, you don't have the long bye, but to be 5, 6, 7, 8, Oregon probably has to be two-loss Big Ten runner-up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe two-loss, maybe a one-loss Big Ten runner-up. I don't know. I think they'd still be top four if that's the case. It's hard to know exactly because of what else is going to happen around the country. But to me, you know, two losses might be what they need. And how are you going to tell Dan Lanning, Dan, you got to lose two games,
Go lose to Indiana at home.
He's going to laugh at you.
Lose at Iowa.
But if they, if they happen to, like, that Oregon's in a win-win. Because if they play to win and they happen to lose and they get the 5, 6, 7, 8 seed, they're in a great position. If they play to win and they win and they're a top four seed, you know, they're still in good shape, right?
First world problem.
Don't want to do is drop to the third tier where you've got to play the opening round game on the road.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. Dan Lanning locked in, fired up. John Wilner, you're the best. I appreciate you, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for having me.
What's on tap this weekend? Glad you asked. I've got you covered. Stick around. You got the bald-faced truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.